Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, April 30th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, Pete Sampson on the road with The Athletic. And guys, you were not on our Monday podcast, so I want to turn it over to you both for some blue-gold game thoughts, maybe primarily, but also spring as a whole. This is our week to talk about the blue-gold scrimmage. No running clock, Pete Sampson. I know you were a fan of that. But still, you do get to see individuals, as Tim Priester said on our podcast. You don't see schemes, you don't see groups, but individuals can shine in that game.
Yeah, and I know Tim mentioned Jaden Sanders. He was kind of one of the guys that popped for me on Saturday. You know, I think it's you know, guys that move from like question mark to like, oh, he might help you. Like I was pretty skeptical that Devin Fitzgerald was going to help them this year. I'm not anymore. You know, and that may be in a very supporting, deep supporting role. So yeah, there are guys like, I thought that the defensive line that came out of spring, incredibly impressed by that group. I think the defense has got a chance to be kind of even better than what I thought. I could hear offense coordinators all over the country with their tiny violins when Chris Ash was like, I don't know where this depth is you keep telling me about. And I'm just like, dude, look at your roster. So yeah, and I would say on the flip side, the receiver position was probably my biggest disappointment of spring because I just thought it would be Faison and Graham and they'd get a couple other guys in that group. And I think you leave, I know they felt like they had a top five, but I feel like they have a top two and then they've got a bunch of guys that need to prove it. And I thought that's probably the position where I feel like they've got the most ground to gain during the summer and in a training camp.
Yeah, Sanders for me, and we had talked about him, I think, on last Thursday's pod, and then he followed up with Saturday just flashing, you know, he's got such great physical skills and plays. I mean, he's got a great frame, but he plays even larger than his six-foot frame just because of how long his limbs are and kind of how he moves and how fluid he is. So he shined. Look, they made a field goal inside Notre Dame Stadium. That's not insignificant based on how last year went. And it was from beyond 40 yards, a field goal from beyond 40 yards. I thought also Manias Williams flashed, not a surprise, but he flashed. And you saw some things in the running game that I know we've got some questions about that. And Notre Dame will continue to have questions about that all the way into the season and probably through the first month of the season or beyond. But I thought we saw some things there. And then just – again, to me, when I look at what Marcus Freeman has done and you think back to the blue gold game of 2022, and then you think back to last Saturday's blue and gold game, just the disparity in talent differential all over the field. And now what Notre Dame will be able to do on every kick coverage, whether it's punt, kickoff, you name it, there's so much vastly superior skill and athleticism and talent than what Marcus Freeman was trotting out there for field goal block or kickoff coverage or punt coverage or anything. So that stands out to me. I mean, their linebackers, you know, Chris Ash can bellyache all he wants. They've got 8, 9, 10 linebackers that a lot of programs in college football would want any one and all of those guys.
I think the part about the wide receivers, and I don't push back because I think they have two also, you could see five more that could make the next two. If you get to top four, you could see Jaden Greathouse, one of Micah Gilbert, Quincy Porter, Devin Fitzgerald, if he really keeps coming along. Yeah. Elijah Burris, it was great to see him do something because I'd been high on him for a year and a half, and he finally did something in front of us. You know, Bubba Frazier's farther down the list. But I think Bubba Frazier's the guy that went from, oh, wow, he's going to be something someday, and probably stays there right now. But, yeah, I agree. Those two receivers are so obvious. They really need Jaden Greathouse to be some semblance of Jaden Greathouse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's not always, we can't always say, it's weird we say Penn State or Miami. Just be Jaden Greathouse before you got hurt your freshman year. He was really good then. That's about the level. So that would be the only pushback I have on receiver. I absolutely agree those two are the guys. Boy, it's huge they got Mylon Graham. You met.
Yeah. And they need, I mean, they need Porter to hit. And the good thing is if you're the fifth or sixth wide receiver at Ohio State, that means you're a first round pick. So I've no doubt that he will be great.
He will be hitting at some point. That's true. And I did done a couple shows since. I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on this. I think most people are in this position with the offensive line, where it should be a very good offensive line, but it's not yet. But can they be a offensive line without Jagusa? Let's just say without Jagusa. That wins semifinals and championship games. I know they're an offensive line that can handle its business in this 2026 season, Will the offensive line go into BYU and shove them around to the point where BYU can't do anything about it? They won't be like Miami's offensive line last year. Can they go into the Miami game and take over like Notre Dame did against Clemson in 2022? Something along those lines. I'm not sure about that from the offensive line yet. And this is another small violin playing compared to most programs' offensive lines, I guess.
I think for me, that's a very valid and fair question. It's also one that Notre Dame doesn't have to answer in weeks 1 and 2 the way it did this past year. Yeah. So I would think by the time October 17th rolls around, we'll see a very good version of a Notre Dame offensive line as close to reaching its ceiling, probably without Jagasaw at that point, as it can possibly be. I mean, I think we all believe in the tremendous upside of Agirby Lambert and what he can do. Yes. And he got some key experience last year. And then Will Black will have played half dozen games by then, 5 games by then, presumably, as long as he's injury free, he should be much better. They're encouraged by the improvement in Absher. Ashton Craig should be back by then. I think that's a huge difference. As much as we talk about what we expect out of this offensive line, we haven't seen this offensive line not only with Jagasaw, but also not with Ashton Craig, its presumptive starting center. I think those are key. Anthony Knapp, you know, is going to battle his tail off at left guard, and it's probably a more natural position for him. So if Will Black comes along quickly, then I think you're talking about having some really good pieces that with or without Jagasaw, as long as you keep Ashton Craig healthy. I would contend Ashton Craig is a bigger person to have returned than Jagasaw, in my opinion. I firmly believe that for the totality of Notre Dame's season, I think you absolutely, because you don't want to go to Joe Otting's backup center. We've seen that's not a scenario that Notre Dame wants any part of. So in that scenario, if you've got Ashton Craig back and they stay relatively healthy, I do think the upside is there for this to be a team that can win a semifinal game and punch a ticket to the national championship contest again.
Check back on October 17th. They have a really long runway to get things figured out. I did a story in The Athletic. I talked to Alex Barsh, Josh Lugg, and Jared Patterson about, like, all right, what does it take to move around within an offensive line? Because I think we are like, we'll just move them to guard or move them to the left side or the right side. Like, what's the problem? And all three of them, to a man, were just like, it's way more complicated than that. Your eyes, the way your body's put together, the Barsh talked about, he always felt great pulling right because he could fit his right arm into like a defender's shoulder pads. But if he was pulling left, he really struggled with that. And like, we don't know anything about, who's good at that and who's not. I agree that if you have Craig back by October 17th, which they should, that's significant. And the last point is, do they need to shove people around in the playoffs or do they just need to protect CJ Carr? Because isn't like a Riley Leonard team where you got to shove people around to have success offensively. This is, I think, going to be much more dependent on, like, do your tackles hold up? And then can you just be assignment correct up the middle? This is, I think, it'll be much more of a pass pro offensive line than a we own the line of scrimmage and shove you around offensive line.
Two announcements coming Friday, potentially for Notre Dame. Top 100 edge rusher. Top 100 overall player and edge rusher Aiden O'Neill, and of course Champ Mons at quarterback. Mons is going to announce on the Pat McAfee show around 1 o'clock. Pete Sampson, you think Aiden O'Neill would have fit in back in the day of Jonathan Williams, Bo Wallace, and the other guys they would bring as defensive end in the mid Brian Kelly era?
We've come a long way from that, Tim.
Yes, Notre Dame with a good chance on both of those. And we get questions each week. This is switching gears, sorry. We get questions each week on Wisconsin kickoff time. JB, at some point you thought you might have, if not an answer, an inkling and a likelihood on that. And it is, of course, September 6th at Lambeau Field. People all forget that was supposed to be the 2020 Shamrock Series game. And this is now in 2026.
Yeah. And the thought had been, especially for the last few months, that this game would be earlier in the day because Ole Miss, I think, plays Louisville also that night. And it's a primetime game. But my latest information is that NBC doesn't care. Sort of scoffed at the notion that people might tune into Ole Miss and Louisville over Notre Dame and Wisconsin and Lambeau Field. And so I'm told to expect a 6:30 kickoff for that game. Obviously not official, but that is the expectation. It was pointed out to me on Twitter. I can't remember who, but thank you for pointing out to me after we discussed this last and said it might be a mid-afternoon game. NBC has a 3 o'clock baseball game that Sunday afternoon, presumably with pennant stakes by that point in the season, by that point in the MLB season. And I'm told that that game is expected to lead straight into the Notre Dame Wisconsin broadcast.
6:30 Central, then I take it, right?
7:30. Correct.
So yep. Yeah. It allows us to stay in Milwaukee instead of having to drive early that night. That helps out a little bit. September 6th, by the way, later than usual start date. Priester and I were talking about that, trying to figure out when camp would start. It doesn't have to be July 28th, like it has been the last couple of years, but do not get used to that necessarily. Pete Sampson, as an Irish media member, this nice late start gives you a little extra vacation time. But JB, you're thinking this might not always be the case going forward for the Irish.
Well, it's not so much what I'm thinking. Nobody cares what I think. I think I know that for sure. But what it is that the NCAA actually sort of under the radar or didn't get as much attention. I don't know why, Brendan Sorsby. But anyway, this maneuver didn't get as much attention. And that is the NCAA is moving to a 14-week calendar to play your 12 regular season games. Week zero will no longer need like special permission or special dispensation. Now any team can play its 12 games across the breadth of a 14-week calendar. And I think that starts as soon as 2027. But that's the nuts and bolts of that, is that you're about to see a lot more week zero games, because by playing week zero, you're going to give yourself two byes over the course of your 12-game season. And if you're a team like Notre Dame that anticipates an incredibly long playoff run and also has quite a bit of travel on most years, then you're going to want two byes. So that's the nuts and bolts of that one. Just an interesting thing that hasn't been greatly discussed, in my opinion. In fact, I didn't notice it. I think the day the NCAA passed it, I usually get alerts on that. So anyway, a 14-week calendar to play your 12-week season, which was told to me is going to mean a lot more week zero games.
Notre Dame announced today, Notre Dame Director of Athletics Pete Pavakwa announced today that Ron Paulus is named the program's first ever Chief Operating Officer. In addition to that, Garrett Chapman named Deputy Athletics Director in charge of financials. And Katie Capps, a Senior Associate Athletics Director, will be also named Senior Woman Administrator in Waiting. Of course, Pete Sampson, Missy Conboy, was the first to ever hold that title, and she is retiring this summer. The Paulus news made it just in time. There was no podcast jinx, Pete Sampson. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's... I mean, it's definitely I feel like they do a lot of reorgs in the athletic department. Also, the athletic department and athletics in general have changed so much that it precipitates a lot of reorgs. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's a position that you have to have, because it's not like budgets didn't matter before, but with the rev share being part of it, matters a heck of a lot now. And it's just like the financial.
I think Pete froze.
Yeah, so I'll pick up. Yeah, so it's that is all. I understand the rear, because you get the finances are kind of be first and foremost now in athletics.
We'll have more discussion on this, I think, in the coming weeks, because this comes within 2 weeks of Pete Bevacqua meeting individually with every single one of his head coaches for all 26 sports on campus. There have been 9 sports that have basically been indicated to that they will be priority sports. And there are 17 sports that have been indicated to that will be maintained sports. As you talk about budget, Pete, that means there's budget freezes, budget cuts. There's some scholarship changes, all of that. So we'll have more of that over the course of the summer. It's certainly something that we're looking into at USA Today, talking to with some local people as well. T.O.?
You want to hear more about CJ Carr, bad recruiting classes, Teddy Girard, Keon Keeley, Shields Family Hall, and a naysayer among us on the message boards. Join us for segment 2, Burning Up the Boards, coming up. Welcome back to segment 2, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from Manantee. He is the naysayer among us, it seems. No clear-cut number one wide receiver, an obvious drop-off at running back, an O-line without its best player, a tight end room searching for a starter. Are we sure this team is better than last year? I mean, are we really?
I mean, offensively, that's a fair question. Defensively, they are better than last year. I would push back a little bit on the tight end part.
I would too. Yep.
I would push back on, I'm not convinced Jagasaw is the best offensive lineman. I think has the potential to be really good, and he has a bunch of attributes that, forget that we like them, the coaches love them. And scouts love them, but we haven't seen them with remote consistency to say he's definitively Notre Dame's best offensive lineman. I mean, right now, I think there's a pretty strong argument that Anthony Knapp is Notre Dame's best offensive lineman. He's proved it on the field for two full seasons, even doing so as a true freshman. I would contend that Gerby Lambert has every bit the ceiling overall as a Charles Jagasaw, and Will Black may be right there as well if he gets his weight up. So I'm not there on the best offensive lineman missing. Would Charles Jagasaw play? Heck yeah, he would play. But again, go back to my segment one comments on Ashton Craig too. I would contend for this team that Ashton Craig is as important, if not more important than Jagasaw. The tight ends, I think they're incredibly encouraged by them. Yeah, they're not remotely as good at running back, but for the first time under Marcus Freeman, they have a returning starter at quarterback.
They're a better overall team. I am sure they're a better overall team than last year because of the defense and because CJ Carr. CJ Carr was a mild mini question mark going into last year. He didn't win the starting job until August 17th, as it turns out. So I know he had better competition. Yeah, if you want to start drilling down, I think we can't stop joking about how is Notre Dame better off at quarterback now than the last 2 years? Well, the last 2 years ago, CJ Carr was fourth string, so I'm not so sure about that. But CJ Carr, if healthy, will be Notre Dame's best quarterback in a long time. So I am pretty definitive that they are better as a team. Find questions on offense. You can find some questions on offense for sure. Next question, Youper Irish, I think. Like phonetic though. Youper Irish. Considering the offensive plan of attack that you expect, which CJ Carr season is most likely from these below? The Jimmy Clausen, which is 28 touchdowns, 4 picks, about 3,700 yards. The Brady Quinn, 37 TDs, 7 picks, about 3,900 yards record. Ian Book, in his best year, was 34-6. I did forget that. About 3,000 yards, so obviously a lot less downfield and a little bit of running. Or merely CJ Carr last year with more touchdown passes because Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price are gone.
I think it's going to be up to a lot better than CJ Carr last year. I think, and this is why, to get back to Manatee's question, like, are we sure they're better? Well, you need Carr to make a huge jump for that to be the case. So I think it's going to have to be somewhere between Clausen and Quinn there, and maybe, frankly, it may be closer to Quinn in 2006.
Yeah, I think it'll be closer to that Brady Quinn, or that's the projection I have. You have to remember also it's a 12-game schedule with the expectation of playoffs beyond that. So anything short of a 14-game season for Notre Dame in 26, I think, would be widely viewed as a significant disappointment. So he's going to have a couple more games to throw up those numbers. He's not going to have the ground yardage that Ian Book had or the rushing touchdowns, because I don't think they're going to give him the opportunities to have the rushing touchdowns. They don't want that. And then remember, we saw CJ Carr run some quarterback draw early last year, and Denbrock had a good feel for using that with CJ Carr. But you had Kenny Minchie, who almost won the starting job, on the sideline at that point. You don't have that this year.
Go ahead, JB.
Oh, yeah, it is question three. That's my fault. I thought we were still on number two. All right, Irish from A2. What is the worst recruiting class for Notre Dame in recent memory? Not just on the class ranking itself, but the impact the recruits made in their time at Notre Dame. I don't know what the time frame is for recent, but we'll say, you know, since 2005 for the purposes of this question. And T.O., we'll start with you.
I don't know if it's fair to say Brian Kelly's first class, because they kind of had to do that one on the fly, but TJ Jones became a team MVP. Lewis Nix became a crucial part of a championship run. Tommy Reese, it's not his fault they couldn't recruit over him. He helped Notre Dame. That's how I like to look at the Tommy Reese era. I mean, you can complain all you want, but he helped to get places. But if that's your number one quarterback in a couple year span, that's also not good. But the 2010 class, you know, then you're looking at Shembo. Bennett Jackson became a sleeper. And for all he did well and became a team captain, Austin Collinsworth, when I mention you as one of the top guys that I'm listing off here, it's probably not a good sign either. So the 2010 is one that popped into my head as not rated high, but also wasn't great. TJ Jones, obviously. TJ Jones did his thing. But you should get a team MVP candidate somewhere, right, Pete?
Yeah. I went 28.
Oh, Pete froze, as he was saying, I think 2018, probably.
2018.
Yeah.
So
if you think of that, JB, so 18 would be.
Yeah. So they signed 27 guys.
Can you repeat? You froze.
Yeah, I went 2018. They signed 27 guys, 2 draft picks. Tommy Tremble, 3rd round. Jarrett Patterson, 6th round. All the top guys in the class basically were busts or role players. And it was ranked 9th. So that was a. And yet, How did Notre Dame do in 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021? Pretty well.
Pretty well. That's true. Yeah, the best real player in the class was Jarrett Patterson, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the rankings, though. These were the guys ranked the highest amps on 24/7 Sports. I want to go to the composite because I can do those type of things with one click. The actual highest ranked player, Houston Griffith, Kevin Austin, Phil Dracovic, Shane Simon, Jack Lamb, Derek Allen, Jason Adamiola, Braden Lindsey, George Tackett's, Lawrence Keys, Bo Bauer, Noah Boykin, and down to Jarrett Patterson, who was flanked by Micah Jones. Pete Sampson, I cede the floor to you. You won. 2018 was the worst class. TJ Jones was an MVP. So, and look, it wasn't fair to Kelly either, like to say that class was, that's a tough situation coming in. Next question, CMU Devils fan. Generally speaking, Notre Dame has had a pretty good hit rate on transfers coming into the program. This got me thinking about guys who have transferred out, and it's almost like they were never heard from again. Since the BK era, are there any players who are meaningful contributors at Notre Dame, decided to transfer out, and had better careers at their next stops?
John, you got anybody?
It's certainly heightened in the portal era, where at some point you're going to just lose someone that's important.
Lorenzo Styles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Lorenzo Styles is a great one. You know, Angeli had a great first year, or was off to a great start for Syracuse. Now he's back, so we'll kind of get a chance to see. Kenny Minchie's going to be the starter at Kentucky. I actually just sat down with Kenny last week for an upcoming feature. I'll be excited to share that in the coming weeks on USA Today. So he had some very interesting comments there. But for the most part, no. Like the transfers that Notre Dame has lost, be it under BK or Marcus Freeman of late, have not been guys that you've gone and said, oh, wow, Notre Dame really misses that dude. I'm sure you can cherry pick a handful of them or some decommitments late in the game or something like that. But no, by and large, like Notre Dame, especially under Marcus Freeman, has retained almost precisely who it has needed to retain.
I thought they would miss Rico Flores. It's not like the receivers have been great. I just think Flores would have been better at Notre Dame than leaving and trying to restart. And obviously that panned out that way. Hey, this is a related question. It was on Monday Musings because Pete Sampson mentioned Lorenzo Styles. He is the most recent Notre Dame drafted wide receiver to be Notre Dame's recruited wide receiver to be drafted in the NFL is Lorenzo Styles. Who is the last Notre Dame recruit as a wide receiver to be drafted in the NFL prior to that?
Kevin Austin? Oh, I can't.
I think it was Claypool, wasn't it?
Claypool.
That's Chase Claypool. The funny thing is the other two guys you could say are Xavier Watts and Cam Hart, who like Lorenzo Styles changed positions. So Chase Claypool is the 2016 class, is the last wide receiver to be drafted in the NFL. That's now they've had really good defensive backs brought in as wide receiver. So that's and you know what? Xavier Watts and Cam Hart really helped, and Lorenzo Styles helped his other school too. So those are good players, but it's not the same thing.
Hey, I think I think that was a username change, CMU Devils fan.
I don't know if he was trying to get in because he did that as a joke.
Yeah. or if it's playoff hockey related.
It's very interesting. It worked. See, he got on the podcast. So maybe he just figured I would see the CMU fan and put it on there. Longtime contributor here, Kevin Garrity 8. I am aware that it is a challenge without him on campus yet, but all the talk currently and rightfully so is about a QB battle 2 between Grubbs and Hebert. Realistically, could Teddy Gerrard come in on short notice and take the reins as QB2?
I'd say it's not super realistic. I also don't know how important it is. I know there's a lot of quarterback 2 discourse. I don't think whoever's QB2 this season will have anything to do with who's QB1 in 2027.
I think that's the best way of putting it. So I'm not sure that Teddy, he's already reclassified. So he's not just a guy coming in summer. He's coming in summer a year before he was supposed to be here, or at minimum 6 months before he was supposed to be there. So I think that's probably a little bit too tall of a task, but by him reclassifying and getting here by the 1st of June in 2026, it positions him to compete for what we believe will be an open quarterback race in spring of 2027, because CJ Carr is going to continue to project as a first round NFL draft pick.
You know, I talked about this on a previous edition. I think it was a podcast. I don't think Teddy Gerrard's name is going to be listed number 2 when we see the first thing come out in August. But we might hear by week 6 when there's a bye, hey, Teddy Gerrard is no longer with the scout team. And whether they put him on that list or not, you might hear Teddy Gerrard is practicing with the varsity And if something happens, I could see Teddy Girard being involved. Now, I mean, do you want to put in Noah Grubbs, Blake Hebert, or Teddy Girard at BYU at night? It's bad all around. So if Girard can make strides in the months he's on campus, that's just way different than hitting campus in August and trying to beat the guys out. That, I mean, there's the drop off from CJ Carr is so big, we have no idea, but I'm sure that those guys gave Dembrock and Gaduli some inclination, like, all right, one of these guys has it here mentally where we can go to them if we need to.
Sure. They got it. Yeah. I was going to say they got to know quick because you can't right. Like, we'll figure it out in the spring. Nope. Portal's open and closed.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You guys think about this. Blake Hebert is the number two in a short-term injury situation because the quarterback run game could get back in the playbook, similar to Riley Leonard. And that's a little bit simpler to process. You can kind of muddle your way through it in a way that, like, Noah Grubbs has to more of, like, run the whole offense, which is kind of a big ask.
It's a good point. Ben Talk made a good point on Instant Analysis. He noted that, you know, Hebert, he made that great throw to Elijah Burris. Mm-hmm. He will have to become better at accuracy and stuff on the check down easy junk, that if you miss it, it kind of mucks up the whole operation, because it absolutely should not be 2nd and 10. It should have been 2nd and 2 because you missed that pass. So that's a good point, though, Pete. You could rely on Hebert. He doesn't run like Riley Leonard, but I know you're saying that the running game could be brought in.
Question number 6 from VA Doc 88, another longtime contributor, a much better question asker than that Molyneux guy. And let's say, in the first 2 games of Freeman's first 4 seasons, the Irish have gone 3-5. What gives you confidence that Freeman has learned how to win early season games? Pete, let's start with you since I opened with O'Malley the last time.
Nothing tangible, honestly. I mean, I kind of want to ask Marcus about this in May when we sit down with them, but they just should be really good. That's it. Like, I don't know if he's, I don't know, he's great lessons learned, just like the team's way better. Like, Wisconsin should score 8 points and Rice should score 3. Like, so it should be all right. That's my expert analysis there.
I mean, that's actually pretty good analysis. That's why it would happen. Because if it was Miami and, I don't know,
if they're opening at Ohio State again, I wouldn't be like, Ohio State, what lessons have you learned?
You'd be a little worried about one of those games, wouldn't you?
This is a John Bryce special. One of the lessons learned is don't open at Miami.
Yeah. He has had some rough openers. 3-5 looks so weird. Like, don't you in your mind think 4-4, but it's totally 3-5, but in your mind, 3-5 is nuts. That is, it's 2-5 if you count FBS teams. I agree with Pete. It's just like, I don't know, how do you lose to either one of those teams? I don't want to have a podcast if they lose to Wisconsin. Oh, it'd be funny to have a podcast if they lost to Rice, but I don't want to have a podcast if they lose to Wisconsin. The Rice one, sometimes.
I don't know what kind of sense of humor you've got.
You just gotta live through it.
That's a dumb sense of humor. It'd be funny to host a podcast after a Rice loss.
O'Malley's in for like a headline with a Rice loss.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just saying Wisconsin would be deflating. Rice, you'd be like, I don't know. What are you going to do? If you lose to Rice in week 2, you really should have stopped thinking about everything else. Next question is a 2-parter from Funny Education, new contributor. What are some realistic expectations for Keon Kelly this season, and what have they been saying inside the Goog? And also related from Denver Maximus, what was more surprising or concerning this spring, the apparent absence of Kelly or Greathouse's complete absence? Will either play a major role this fall? Who does ND need more to play a major role this fall to compete for a title?
Oh, Greathouse. I mean, by a wide margin. I think Keon Kelly, if he's just Josh Burnham this year, that's probably okay. I wouldn't describe that as a major role. I wouldn't say it's insignificant, but he's a number 2. Greathouse needs to be a number 1.
Yeah. What have we heard inside the Goog that, you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Keon Kelly would unequivocally be a sharpied in starter by this point in time, and a guy that you know you're going to depend a lot on? I think this year, Keon Kelly will be depended a lot on as a rotational guy, but he does not have to be the guy. And I don't get the sense that there's any expectation he will be the guy. He's not the most talented defensive lineman. He's not probably the 2nd or 3rd most talented defensive lineman from the collective, you know, 10 man group or whatever, but he's definitely a dude that you expect to help you and to play a role for you. He's better than what's his name from Duke a couple of years ago.
I can't believe you just bring that up, because I was going to say he'll be better than RJ Oben.
What's his name from Duke?
He'll he'll be better
Riley
than
Leonard? RJ
Oben. But, yeah. Riley Leonard might have been a better defender than RJ Oben. So.
If Keon Keeley makes the play of the year in the Sugar Bowl,
yeah,
Keon Keeley did his job, but I expect Keon Keeley to make that play intermittently during the season 5 times, and you hope it's against Miami, Brigham Young, SMU, the Sugar Bowl, and Ohio State, not Purdue. Well, we know that Rice is going to block everybody on Notre Dame, as we just pointed out. But if it's against Purdue, Rice, Michigan State, and Stanford, it's different. I like to see Keon Keeley make some plays. Pete, I don't think actually neither one of you guys are on Monday. The Keon Keeley I saw against Oklahoma, that's what I just described. The Keon Keeley I saw against Indiana is the reason you lose to people that you should never lose to, because he had no. I don't know how Alabama could have no interest, but they just started getting their asses kicked and they had no interest. And you could see it. I was really watching Keon Keeley. He wasn't the same player 1 week later. So, you know, it's a consistency issue. We have an old Pete Sampson favorite name here. Happy Gilmore.
That is an amazing name.
That's incredible. Happy Keith Gilmore. How is the new football facility? Will you get a tour? Will you get an office? Will it be open for public viewing at some point?
Well, I guess we'll talk to CEO Ron Paulus to see if we can get some office space over there. I have not, I mean, I've heard July is a target date in terms of like moving in there. So that is, yeah, July is a target date to move in there. So that's imminent now. And I think there will be a media tour at some point, but not holding out hope for an office.
Yeah. COO, not CEO. Get his title right.
Sorry. I think my internet dropped out. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Yes, but I believe actually they're preparing to they're close to being able to do some stuff in it by the end of May, and I think they may even start serving some team meals in there by June. I'm with Pete on the full open, and then actually I think they've already scheduled a dedication ceremony for around August 7th. So very clearly, if they're doing a dedication ceremony, they're going to be moved in and inhabiting Shields Hall by that point in time. I forget. I'll try to have even more specific information on it next week, but how much they've devoted to sports science and sports nutrition in that space is unbelievable. I don't want to mention the square footage on just because I'm afraid I'll screw it up, and I don't want to mention the exact dollar figure I was told, but it was maybe over $20 million of that facility that's being devoted to sports science and nutrition. And one of the primary entrances will be known as the Hall of Champions. So anyway, just some interesting stuff. But yeah, like August, first week of August, I think there's a dedication ceremony, which will have obviously all the boosters and benefactors that help make that a reality, not just Jack Shields, but the others who have various components of the building that will bear their name. So there you go. That's the latest.
Will we be allowed to say inside the Goog anymore once this happens?
Behind the Shield.
Behind the Shield. The Goog won't feel good anymore for Tom Loy. That will be it. That'll be different.
The Goog will be the Goog will be eventually repurposed, I'm told, into housing, being a training center and housing a number of the other sports on campus. So it will be repurposed down the road into that.
Maybe that's where we can get some office space.
I was gonna say the Isbin Auditorium could become our office.
A podcast studio, maybe.
That would be fantastic. Our final question from Wash ND. Boy, we had some new guys and some old tall timers in this one. Recently, there have been many rankings of the best quarterbacks in college football for the upcoming season. Who is your top 5 post-spring preseason lists? Wash ND wanted the order. I eliminated that because I have control over the questions. So top 5 QBs coming in. Annie adds a question. Or wait, I added this. Does Notre Dame play 3 top 10 QBs? That's an
interesting. So just the top 5 QBs in college football?
Yeah, who are your top 5 QBs? You go first, Bryce. Your top 5 QBs. Don't have to go in order.
I think I have Dante Moore number 1 for me, with Arch Manning number 2, and I would have CJ Carr number 3, with the expectation that CJ Carr plays well enough to be a factor in that conversation among those being the best 3. Probably would have Darian Mensah in that conversation somewhere around 4 or 5. And then Julian Sain, I guess, would round out my top 5. I don't know. I'm a little questionable on having Mensah in my top 5. He's nice, but I know that Tulane was surprised he was as successful as he was last year at Duke. And let's remember that early last season, Tulane still beat that Duke team with its former quarterback at the helm. So maybe I would swap Mensah out. I didn't do a good enough job of reading all through the questions that Taskmaster O'Malley sent this week. So I'll be candid. I just read that question or heard that question for the first time. I apologize, teacher.
I like Manning number one, and then I'm Moore or Carr two or three, three or two. After that, I mean, I like Mayava.
Mm-hmm,
I do too. Yeah, I think he's a really good player. I'd probably go, maybe I'd put Chambliss number five.
I had Chambliss in my top five, Mayava as well, and I would probably go Manning, Carr, Moore. I really like Chambliss in college. I might pull Chambliss up to the top four. Mayava's always impressed us. Jaden Mayava, well, yeah. He did two interception touchdowns to lose the game, but other than that, he's been very impressive. As a pure thrower, he just does a great job. The question about do they play three of the top 10? I don't think so.
No, not even close.
No, but they play Mensah, Jennings, and Bachmeier could be three of the top 20.
Yeah, Bachmeier's good. We'll see how much better he is in the throw game this year. He was able to improvise and run a lot because he's a bigger frame guy. We didn't mention Sam Levitt. Talked with an LSU coach this week. They're really freaking high on Sam Levitt. Believe he's got an NFL future. Obviously, he was hurt and didn't have the year last year that he had the previous year when he took Arizona State into the CFP. So, yeah, it's a good year for quarterbacks in college football. I think it's an improved year for quarterbacks in college football overall.
Top 30 with Steve Angeli maybe as well on the schedule.
The
way he played last year, Steve Angeli was looking like that. You got to be able to play some good quarterbacks if you're Notre Dame in a football schedule, but it's not as daunting as we have seen in the past. Pete Sampson is either mesmerized by my conversation here or he has frozen again in his hotel room.
He's frozen, but Jack is stretching and yawning, which I think is the unofficial official that it's time for us to get the hell out of here.
That is our cue. I think Jeff Bryce probably has something really important to go to in the next 10 minutes too. So that will be it for today. Thank you to Pete Sampson, The Athletic, and his hotel room, John Rice. And I am Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.